Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Sadiq Hamid, a senior research assistant at the University of Oxford and the author of Sufis, Salafis, and Islamists, The Contested Grounds of British Islamic Activism, published by I.B. Torres in 2016. In Sufis, Salafis, and Islamists, Dr. Hamid explores the contours of Islamic activism, and indeed the meaning of this key term in the context of the UK. Despite this specific focus, however, he also gives attention to transnational implications, especially insofar as British Muslims represent a variety of ethnic backgrounds and political influences. Hamid gives meticulous attention to the social and political histories of the groups he studies, including Hizb ut-Tahrir, Young Muslims, and many others. As the title suggests, the author also surveys groups with explicit connections to Sufism and draws connections between Western streams of Sufism, such as those inspired by Hamza Yusuf, Timothy Winter, and Nuh Hamim Keller. Among Hamid's many strengths in his erudite work is his ability to successfully locate uniquely British experiences of Islam within the cacophony of voices that comprise the social makeup of what it means to be British and Muslim. Given the extensive sources that Hamid explores, combined with the timely questions he poses, the monograph will likely attract interest from scholars across disciplines, ranging from history and religious studies to political science and sociology, as well as journalists of many stripes. Without further ado, here's my interview with Dr. Sadiq Hamid. I hope you enjoy.
Good morning, Sadiq. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking about your book, Sufis, Salafis, and Islamists. And here at New Books in Islamic Studies, before we get into the content of the book, we like to ask our authors a little bit about themselves. So could you start off by telling us a little bit about your educational background and any influential mentors you might have had in the process?
Sure. I actually entered academia relatively late in life, in my early 30s, because prior to that, I trained in the social sciences, and I trained specifically in youth and community development. So after my undergraduate studies, I worked professionally with young people for just over a decade. And towards the end of that, I was pursuing a master's in Islamic studies. And it was really there I kind of made a decision to switch careers, and I transitioned into academia and enrolled on a doctoral program at the University of Chester here in the UK, part-time. And I completed that for about 6 years, and my PhD is in religious studies, but I've kind of focused in on Islamic studies and my area of interest, which is Muslim religious identity formation and as it relates to the work of various Islamic trends that have helped shape religious identity in politics and inter-Muslim politics here in the UK over the last three decades or so. I've had a number of academic influences, but specifically for this subject area, it is my ex-supervisor, really, Professor Ron Jeeves, who has been a great influence. And I chose to do my PhD under him because he had actually produced a similar study in his own doctoral work, which looked at sectarian trends within British Islam, and that was published in the mid 90s. So I guess he's been a great influence, and he did because of his work, I was attracted to go and do my PhD with him.
And so given your eclectic background and having this sort of different career trajectory for a while, were there any kind of significant intellectual moments or books that you read that shaped you in a way that might, you know, not be sort of the typical story of someone who goes into academia, like straight through high school and stays, you know, like a lot of people?
Yeah, sure. Even though I was kind of working professionally in community development, I always had an ongoing interest in Islamic studies, generally contemporary Islam, more so than textual studies. I always was reading something, you know, to do with Islam and Muslims in Britain or something of that nature. I think there was a couple of books that really stood out for the study of Islam in Britain, which was, I guess, in the 1990s. It was a relatively new field. And for me, one book that really strike me as a good study was Islamic Britain, written by Philip Lewis. And that was quite a significant work for its time. Although it was a case study of a particular Muslim community in Bradford in northern Britain, the author's kind of analysis and exploration did extrapolate out to many of the experiences of Muslims living across the UK. So that was it's actually a very well-known study, and it's actually a standard text in the field. And that book impressed me. I was at the time, you know, in my early 20s, and I thought, wow, this somebody who's not a Muslim can know so much about Muslim communities. It, for me at that time, it was like it was new. As a non-academic, I didn't really know many non-Muslims who had that level of intimate knowledge and understanding of the various dimensions of the Muslim experience, and that really impressed me. So I guess at the back of my mind, I thought, wow, I'd like to do something like this perhaps one day.
And so finally, before we jump right into the book, what was there any kind of particular moment or series of moments that shaped your interest in the topic that you look at in the book?
Yeah, sure. My supervisor's work was one of the reasons. But actually, as I've stated in the beginning of my book, it was actually a friend of mine, a journalist, quite well-known British Muslim journalist, Faisal Bodhi, who, I think it was in 1993, we were both students at the time, university students, and he wrote an article for the university student Islamic Society newsletter. It was a bit of a satire on the state of Islamic activism on university campuses across the UK. And his article was called "The Players," and it was a kind of neat summary and comparison between Sufi groups, Salafi groups, specifically Salafi groups, and the Islamist groups on campus who were vying with one another for the attention of new undergraduate students on campus. And that struck me at the time was very perceptive. And I guess that was at the back of my mind. It planted a seed. And the other influence actually was my own involvement in various Islamic organizations during the 1990s up to the early 2000s. I've worked and got to know a lot of the main, the activists and leaders, people who I've mentioned in the book. And that practitioner experience, it did indirectly feed into my formal academic study. So, yeah, I've got that kind of personal history as well as the formal academic study, which combined together to prompt me to do this study. And for me, really, it was trying to, writing this was really an attempt for me my involvement to understand what actually happened during the 1990s, because I keep going back to the 1990s as being the defining decade for second generation British Muslims to come to terms with the fact of their Muslimness. So those people who chose to identify as practicing Muslims, those people who started to take their religion seriously and get involved in religious activism and try to, if you like, Islamize their peers and their communities. I mean, this is one of my arguments. The 1990s was the defining decade. Obviously, as you're going through it, you know, you're and as a younger person, you know, you're just trying to make sense of it. And you're in many ways heavily committed to a particular organization or a particular outlook. And it's difficult to take that objective kind of standpoint because you're so immersed in the subject area. And for me, during the early 2000s, I thought, well, you know what? A lot of us went through this. I mean, literally thousands of people went through Islamic organizations during the 90s. And it would be good to do a study, really try to make sense of it, analyze it objectively. And I guess that fed into my decision to do this as a PhD.
So related to the next thing I want to ask you is that, you know, one of the things that you do in the book that I found really helpful is you look at these terms like Salafi and Islamist and then look at the different groups. And, you know, there's certain commonalities, but of course, these groups also define themselves in unique ways. And so I'd like to get into the terminology in a moment, but could you first say a little bit about your title? And you use the term Islamic activism. And so, like, what do you mean by that exactly?
Yeah, so the title, the main three terms, Sufi, Salafis, and Islamists, is it's a deliberate attempt to catch people's attention, obviously, given that those three terms, particularly Salafis and Islamists in recent years, have entered the mainstream public imagination, I guess, through the ongoing period that we are all experiencing in terms of anxieties and fears around terrorism, religious radicalization, and so on. And so, you know, those particular terminologies are in currency in a way which have mainstreamed them. But what I found was that not many people actually understood what they meant. You know, Islamist is often interchanged for radical, militant, fundamentalist, jihadist, you know, sympathizer of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And I think that slippage, I think, is unhelpful, especially certainly in the public sphere, where I think we really need to be careful about what we mean. And sometimes you underestimate the impact of words. And, you know, I think so for me, you know, I wanted to try to, if you like, I mean, this is what we do as educators, obviously, as you know, try to explain and contextualize what these terms mean. And the subtitle, The Contested Ground of British Islamic Activism, is obviously a reference to the competitive nature of the different Islamic tendencies and methodologies that Sufis, Salafis, and Islamists represent, because they are distinct. They are, I mean, obviously they're all Muslim groupings, but they are quite, they have distinct characteristics and approaches to what they mean by Islam. And so it's about unpacking that.
And so what about this idea of British Islamic activism? If we're thinking about this term Islamic activism as something that could be understood in a global context, what would you say particularly shapes the British context, broadly speaking?
Yeah, I mean, so as you know, the Islam historically and certainly in the contemporary world that we live in is inflected by the culture, the dominant culture that it resides in. So here in the West, in North America, in the Europe, and here in the UK, we have a an encultured version of the faith to the extent that people identify an American Islam or Muslim Americans. British Islam is a product of the Muslims who are born or have grown up in Britain and have who identify themselves as culturally British, but also you know, attached to their faith, and it's an attempt at reconciliation, I guess. The kind of hybridized approach, which I think most Muslims in Britain would, I mean, it's an interesting internal kind of debate that is ongoing. I mean, some people say, well, look, there's no, you know, Muslims shouldn't be, you know, trying to develop this project of a British Islam. There is only one Islam, and that is, you know, one that people, you know, aspire to practice. There's a universal, somehow deculturalized, free-floating Islam that's out there that we're all trying to strive towards. And there's, you know, trying to give it prefacing it with a national kind of flavor doesn't make any sense. And that's obviously, that's a political position. It's a theological position for some. But most Muslims in Britain do identify with the country that they're living in. And they recognize that they have internalized many of many of the cultural facets of being a British person, and that in itself is an interesting and longer conversation. But when it comes to their activism, it's really about a specific. I mean, there are different kinds of activism that is done by Muslims in Britain, but I've kind of if you like tried to lay the larger context of that in the book by talking about how those Muslims who were very publicly active getting involved in their communities and wider societies and they were people really from religious backgrounds, and so the activism that they were participating in and advocating was influenced by their particular interpretation of Islam, and the activism. I mean, what were they actually trying to do? They were trying to basically transmit their religious values to younger people, to their peers, and also reach out to their fellow non-Muslim citizens, their friends, neighbors, colleagues, etc. So that's the kind of missionary aspect of it, if you like, proselytizing to the wider society. And for some of these activists, there is a hope that, you know, that they would like to share and spread Islam to the whole of the UK, and in the hopes that you know, the people of Britain would accept Islam. I guess for some people that was a primary objective, for some people it was a secondary objective. But what all of these groups had in common was the agreement around the maintenance and the fortification of their Islam in their personal and collective lives. And hence, the activists were all trying to do the same thing in that way. They were trying to strengthen their sense of self and their Islam, and at the same time, it was a personal but also a public act. The personal was about the individuals developing the individual relationship with God, passing these values onto their families, but also trying to reach out to what they would consider lapsed Muslims in their localities and their communities. So we know, this is a fact nowadays that many Muslims in minority contexts, and it's not just in minority contexts, we see this in Muslim majority contexts in the world, in as well. We see the younger people who express less of an interest in their faith, and measuring religiosity in things like prayers. Pray how many, if they pray at all, if they pray five times a day, if they attend the mosque, the Friday prayers, and so on. I mean, those kind of markers, I mean, those kind of measurements, you know, what we are seeing is a gradual decline in religious practice in the second and third generations. I know it's very similar in the US, but here in the UK, it's been on a gradual decline. And so these activist groups' primary objective were trying to reverse that general trend of decreased religiosity, and they would argue increased secularity. And really what we're witnessing most recently is an increase in atheism as well.
So what about in terms of basic demographics and percentages? How many Muslims are there in Britain, to help our listeners understand the context?
Yeah, so in terms of numbers, it's an always imprecise thing because, I mean, in the UK, we have a national census that takes place every 10 years. So the last on the last count in 2011, there was approximately 2.7 million Muslims recorded through the census data. Now that, you know, we are getting on 7 years after that. So, you know, most people would recognize, I think, that that 2.7 million is a dated figure now. And we have, people say really be closer to 3 million, if not more than 3 million Muslims in the UK. And in terms of the further specific breakdowns, the UK Muslim population is predominantly South Asian. That is to say, from mainly Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India. And so we then also have Muslims from everywhere else as well, from the Middle East, from Africa, from Southeast Asia, and so on. But if you look at breakdown geographically, in the UK we have about, London has the single most concentrated Muslim community, which is well over a million, and then Muslim communities are condensed in the Midlands. We have the original Birmingham. here there's a large community in Birmingham and in middle of the country, and then the communities are quite densely populated in the northwest of the country, in the major cities of Manchester, Bradford, and so on. And then we have significant communities in Scotland as well, and a very small community in Northern Ireland. As you know, England is the UK is a very small island compared to the US, but I think historically the communities arrived in significant numbers in the early 60s, and it's continued to grow, almost doubling in the last 10 years actually. So if you look at the figures for 2001 census and you look at figures for 2011, it's been a huge increase actually. It's over more than a million people, and the community is very diverse in the cosmopolitan areas like London and Birmingham and Manchester, but in the northwest of the country it's less ethnically diverse. It's mainly the South Asian, Bangladeshi, Indian, Pakistanis who make up most of the Muslim communities.
And so connecting this to the different groups that you studied and who belongs to which groups and that sort of thing, you have a very helpful glossary at the beginning of the book that identifies the various acronyms you use to help the reader keep track of the many groups you look at. And so what would you say is like one of the most significant groups that you looked at in your study?
Well, again, because of the predominantly South Asian complexion, I guess you could say, the Muslims, with their ethnicity, there is a kind of a historical accompanying theological / sectarian affiliation. So most Muslims from South Asia would come from a Diobandi or Brailwi theological kind of heritage. For listeners who aren't aware, I mean, these are specific late 18th century, early 19th century theological kind of tendencies, which kind of arose in the Indian subcontinent, and then there were ways of. In terms of hermeneutics towards the tradition and these scriptural sources, but also in its relationship to England as an occupying colonial force. So the Diobandis were specifically a response to the English colonial powers and so on. And I give a little bit of background around that. So, you know, they're kind of ethno-sectarian ways of kind of organizing themselves. And so in the UK, even though they are arguably the largest theological traditions. I made a point that given their relative lack of sophistication and lack of interest amongst young people during the early phases of my study, and I actually began in the mid-80s, my argument is that despite the numerical kind of density of the Diobandi and Brelvi oriented Muslims, it was actually the Islamist reformist tendencies that really kind of had it, were switched on to what was going on in the second generation, and they were the first to become organized and to try to engage second generation Muslim youth in a way that the Diobandis and Brelvis were not equipped to do. Basically, essentially, they didn't have the tools, the communication skills, or frankly speaking, the interest to engage their young people, and that caused frictions and interesting kind of tensions between young people who were moving away from the Diobandi Brelvi influence. Also, for those non-South Asian Muslims from different tendencies, we also had other ideas floating around. So the Salafi, you know, during the 1980s, the Salafi influence was starting to also take root. And we saw our organized efforts to promote that particular view. And that is, I mean, I basically looked at the Islamists and the Salafis as the most active group, most organized groups amongst second generation British Muslims in the mid 80s. Now, things in the 1990s started to become a bit more complicated and a bit more interesting. And that's where I argue that we had the emergence of an activist form of Sufism. And so I use these labels as ways of understanding this very competitive, relational kind of dynamic that was taking place to essentially influence the hearts and the minds of young people from Muslim backgrounds. And that, for me, that I make this point because if the Sufis and the Salafis and the Islamists had not done what they were doing, it's unlikely that we would have had the very complex Islamic landscape that we have today, because today is a direct legacy of what happened in the 1980s and the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of the study that you look at in the context of the UK in particular, how do you define Salafi and Islamist? Because, you know, as you know, and a lot of people assume these are kind of interchangeable terms, and of course they're not. And so what would you want our listeners to know in particular about how these terms are different?
Sure. Academics know well that when it comes to definitions, I mean, it's always it's contested. we love to argue the finer points of how we characterize different types of religious formation and identity. And so, there's different ways of scholars have tried to distinguish between different types of Muslim religiosity. So, for me, interestingly, when I've spoken to, I've had a different reaction when I've spoken to Muslim audiences and non-Muslim audiences. So, non-Muslim audiences have been quite open, and I guess because they don't have necessarily the background knowledge to question. But when I'm amongst Muslims, they say, "Well, look, why are you using this? Why are you using these terms, Islamist and Salafi? You know, who even uses that term?" And we, you know, so people who would be described as Islamists have said to me, "Why are you using that term?" And I say, "Well, you know, first of all, they are academic labels. They are ways of understanding different types of religiosity. But also, in the UK specifically, you know, we've had a very kind of intense scrutiny and pressure really applied on politically active Muslims over the last 10 years because of the securitized nature of the discussion. But Islamists, I mean, it's one of those, it's a very highly controversial term and a catch-all term that for some people would mean any politically active Muslim. But that really isn't enough. I mean, Islamism is, it's a very broad mosque, if you like, of different tendencies, some moderate and some more extreme. And essentially, they are people who believe that their faith has a very important influence in how they shape their private and their public life. And Islamists are very much interested in shaping the public sphere in the realms of politics, economics, and so on. And historically, the Islamist people who kind of shaped it intellectually, the reformers and the revivalists of particularly the 19th century and the early 20th century, were very much interested in capturing state power and responding to colonialism. So, you know, unfortunately, I guess in the last 10 to 15 years, and certainly in the UK, the term Islamist has become very much discredited, and it's almost actually, it's become a term of abuse. So if anybody is assertive politically, they're often dismissed as being an Islamist, and without any kind of real regard. What is it? What did this person want? You know. So, I mean, I've used it as a category to describe the different type of reformist trends that were influenced by 19th century and early 20th century ideologues, you know, genealogically linked to the thinkers that emerged from the Ikhwan al-Muslimun, the Muslim Brotherhood movement, and the Jamaat Islami movement in the Indian subcontinent. I think specialists will know that these two movements are the biggest Islamic movements in the Muslim world, and they've exercised a very large influence over immigrant Muslim communities in the West as well. A lot of the activist politically active and visible Muslim organizations in Europe, in the UK, and in the US were led by people who were associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and the Jamaat Islami organization. So that's what I mean by Islamist. Salafis are, again, it's a theological trend, which again has a particular genealogy that couldn't be traced to the Wahhabi movement and Ibn Abdul Wahhab, and what was going on in the Arabian Peninsula in the 18th centuries and 19th centuries, and really coming up to the 20th century, and the particular tendency that claims to want to purify Islam of its historical accretions and deviations, and going back to what they claim is going back to the Quran and the Hadith in an unmediated way. So it's a methodological approach, but it also kind of privileges a particular theological perspective as well. And obviously, the Salafi / Wahhabi tendency again has exercised a massive influence globally in the last 20, 30, perhaps 40 years, and has shaped the religiosity of many Muslims. And this is a thing for me. Why the subtitle of the book is called Contested Ground is because it's very much an ongoing contest between Islamists, Salafis, and Sufis. I mean, these three tendencies are paradigms for understanding how Muslims can make claims in the public sphere and make claims around religious authority, religious authenticity, and how the Muslim condition in their particular localities can be addressed. And you know, essentially, I mean, it's defined in the language of problems and solutions. You know, activists talk about, you know, improving the condition of the Muslims, you know, bringing Islam back, you know, bringing the greatness of Islam back and giving dawah and so on and so on. It's they're all messages around reform, revival, and restoring the honor and the pride of Muslims. And that's basically what I try to do, is to unpack what do these act activists actually mean when they use this language themselves? And what is it that they're actually trying to achieve in the UK?
Well, so on this point of defining Salafis and Islamists, of course, the other topic in your title is Sufis. And there's this popular idea that Sufis are quietists and apolitical. And so how do you contextualize Sufism in the context of your study, and how do they fit into this broader picture of activism?
That's right. I mean, again, going back to the particular British experience, we, as I said, had the importation of South Asian varieties of Islamic religiosity, and the dominant, if you like, expression is both among the Diobandis and the Brelovis is a traditional, if you like, Sufism. And here we mean the kind of a subscription to the historical tariqas or taruq, the Sufi orders that were kind of strong and consistent and visible across the centuries, really. And I'm thinking here of the Naqshbandi orders, the Chishtiyah, the Qadiris, the Shadhilis, and so on. I mean, these, you know, the Sufism, you know, the Sufi path, those people who've chosen the, if you like, chosen to emphasize, if you like, the spiritual dimension of Islam, those people who privilege a relationship with their sheikh, their teacher, as being guides to getting closer to God, you know, those people who emphasize particular ritual performances which bring them closer to God, and so on. So, you know, if you like, classical Sufism as it is conceived, that type of understanding was also traveled to the UK with the 1960s generation. And so the thing is, though, that type of religiosity, it became largely irrelevant to the second generation who had been born in the UK in the 1970s, or, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s. People who came of age and, you know, were looking into their religion or had received religious instruction in their local mosques, it would have, given the demographics which I mentioned before, it would have been a particular Brelvi or Diobandi interpretation of Islam, and often with it a kind of aspects of their ethnic Sufism, if you like, which was seen as actually irrelevant and actually almost embarrassing. So Sufism really, for most of the 80s and early 90s, was irrelevant. It was seen as something that our parents did, which we don't really quite understand. And actually, you know, so especially when it came to quite folkloric things like the reverence for the saint, the peer, or the certain types of religious practices that were done on special occasions, you know, these were all things which, you know, a lot of educated second generation Muslims didn't understand and didn't really relate to at all. And it was one of the reasons why they felt, I mean, Islam didn't have anything for them. And you see, this is one of the main reasons, not the only reason, but because it didn't have anything to say to younger people growing up in a secular, predominantly secular, culturally Christian society where they were minorities. You know, their religion was one aspect of their identity. And this is where the activist groups, you know, they explained this situation as being a factor for the gradual turning away from religion. So their argument was that, look, and in their language, they would say, look, the religion that your parents taught you isn't proper Islam. You know, it's not the true Islam. Islam is a way of life. Islam is comprehensive. Islam is much more than just praying five times a day and fasting in the month of Ramadan. Islam has something to say about everything in your life and who you are and what you do, in both private and public. And it has something to offer to the wider society. And so it's a particular worldview. And this for younger people was for some people who were interested, it was something new and different, and it kind of drew them back. And that's the opening that the Islamic groups had. It enabled them to pick apart the particular understanding of Islam that they had, and because a lot of them were coming from Sufi backgrounds, that particular form of Sufism was discredited. Now, what I argue late in the Sufis that I discuss are, if you like, part of a trend which arguably never really went anywhere. It wasn't that it was invisible. It's always been part of historical Sufism, if you like. And obviously, I'm making generalizations, because obviously all of these religious traditions are vast. But to make it a viable kind of subject for study, I had to kind of narrow the term. So when I'm talking about Sufism. I'm talking about kind of break with the traditional historical Sufism that I've just described. The Sufism that emerged in the 1990s among second generation Muslims was really as a result of ongoing efforts by a number of individuals and networks that were already in place. It wasn't something that was kind of like a group of people got together and say, yeah, we have to, invent some new form of religion or a tactic that to get the youth back to Islam. It's always been there. That would be their argument. It was always part of the historical Sufi tradition. But what distinguished this approach to Sufism, I guess, was the public face of particular scholars and the scholarly voices and the work that these individuals had on the second generation. Here I'm thinking of, and some I'm sure a lot of the listeners will be familiar with the name of Sheikh Hamza Yusuf Hansen from the Zaytuna College in California. And he is an individual, although he's an American Muslim, Sheikh, he actually exercised a huge influence here in the UK in the mid 1990s, and that was only possible because of the emerging transatlantic network that was taking place. And this is what I call the traditional Islam network, or the Anglo-American traditional Islam network. It was basically these people who were actually friends, and Hamza Yusuf is a well-known convert. He converted to Islam in 1977. And it's interesting, it was the same year as his analog here in the UK, Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad, or otherwise known as the Cambridge Professor Tim Winters, who is arguably the UK's most famous English Muslim. But it's also the same year that Sheikh Nur Amin Keller, who is based in Jordan, and also the year that Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam, converted. So, and also I believe Imam Zaid Shakir as well. So I don't know what the significance here of 1977, but these are currently very, some of the most well-known converts, personalities we have in the English-speaking world. And these people are our friends. I think it's a network relationship that kind of built upon their prior friendships that were developed, and the working relationship that they had. But it was basically British Muslim activists here in the UK who started to bring over and bring together the converts. Basically, I've pinpointed it to 1995 as being that transition, that landmark year, if you like, where certainly Hamza Yusuf was kind of introduced to the British Muslim community. And he kind of like... he was a breath of fresh air, in the words of many activists at the time. He was he wowed people. I mean, people held, it was just like were taken aback by his knowledge, not only of the traditional Islamic sciences. His Arabic was flawless. I mean, people used to say that his Arabic was better than the Arabs, but he had so much knowledge of the Quran and the Hadith. But also he was very culturally kind of switched on to the ideas and the kind of like tastes of people, modern, second generation Muslims. And so I've argued that he had that influence particularly as a convert figure. You know, he became a hero to many people, but what he also, coming from a Sufi background, that kind of unsettled the other groupings. So the Islamists at first were not sure how to take him, you know, and the Salafis were very suspicious of him. And essentially, he and Abdul Hakim Murad and Nuh Keller and the activists in the UK and in the US, they essentially were the figureheads, if you like, of this transition that took place, where scholarly Sufis were, if you like, repopularizing Sufism as an orientation within Islam. And essentially, I mean, the long story short, Sufism was put back, if you like, back into the mainstream, for some people accuse Sufism of being unorthodox, of it, you know, it being kind of tainted by culture and so on. But what they did was to able to recenter it as being part of the Islamic tradition and actually part of orthodoxy. And that really took the Salafis off guard, because they had always accused Sufis of being somehow a deviant, heterodox tendency within Islam historically.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating. The 1977, that was news to me as well. Now, me and many other listeners are going to want to look into that, see what was going on in that year. And so you mentioned this idea of this Anglo-American traditional Islam network, and in particular Hamza Yusuf and Tim Winter, Abdul Hakim Murad. What significance do you think it is that these are white converts sort of having this influence on Muslim contexts that primarily consists of non-white converts?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think there's a number of things there. I think I'd begin by saying that makes some people feel uncomfortable, but the reality is, and other academics have written about this, is the idea of the white savior kind of complex for Muslims, particularly of South Asian background and perhaps Arab background. You know, it was really this idea of somebody from the West embracing quote unquote our religion as being some kind of a validating kind of effect. I guess I'd begin by saying that. And certainly somebody who was white, you know, the dominant culture, converting to Islam was somehow seen as, you know, honoring Islam and proving the truthfulness of Islam. So this is as a psychological kind of response from peoples who were, you know, we've got to remember, colonized in the not so recent past. So I think for South Asian Muslims and people from, you know, non-white backgrounds, I guess it was like, wow, you know, not only are they converted, but look how knowledgeable they are. You know, look at the scholarly authority that they command. You know, look how many years they've spent studying our religion. So, you know, it was both a source of kind of, in a sense, speaks to a certain amount of psychological inferiority, but also validation and, I guess, pride in that somebody, people from the West, white indigenous people, have acquired the religious competency in a way which most of us haven't been able to. And these people have become our teachers, and they can act. They are seen as bridges between the worlds of Islam, Muslim communities, and the West. So, I mean, those are some of the main kind of things going on in terms of how people responded to figures like Hamza Yusuf and Tim Wedge, and they still do. You know, they see there is a, it speaks to that kind of subtle kind of intellectual, emotional kind of reaction to seeing somebody from the dominant culture speak your language, you know, understand your religion, explain your, being able to articulate your religion to the rest of the world. I think it's satisfying. It's emotionally, it kind of, it makes you feel good, I guess. And I think as well, and this is not a flippant point, you know, for us here in the UK, when we hear the American accent, it makes a difference as well, I tell you. Because we were doing this from the early 90s. We were bringing the American speakers. We had, before that, we had Hamza Yusuf. We had Imam Siraj Al-Hajj, who's still a very popular speaker here. We had Dr. Jamal Badawi and so on, you know. So the Brits really did like to bring over their American cousins quite often. And that, I think, it kind of made them feel good.
And so this next question might seem a little cliche, but this idea of, you know, people like Hamza Yusuf, people see him as like a walking encyclopedia, and that's really attractive on one level. But, you know, in 2018 now, so like, what are some ways you see new media shaping the direction of British Islamic activism? And how is that, you know, different from the kinds of context you look at in the 1990s? So like, what's the sort of future of things looking like from your perspective?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. I only really, I deliberately didn't spend too much time on that in this book. The last chapter is, the penultimate chapter is contemporary Islamic activism, where I just really touch on the answer to your question, which is how the transformation of the activism of the 1990s to the 2000s and bringing it up to date. And what I've done prior to that is to explain the dynamics of social change that enabled, if you like, brought us to where we are today in terms of the social media. Yeah, social media is obviously something that impacts all of our lives. But before that, we have to remember that the British Muslim communities were in a state of transition, as all communities are, with growing populations, populations that were certainly second generation. We had a large cohort that was university educated, and these people went on to then fine-tune certain aspects of the existing activist infrastructure, but also people who had become disillusioned, from the Sufi, Salafi paradigms that they had encountered in the 1990s and started becoming critical and had either left those groups or actually reinvented Islamic activism in their own terms. And we can't forget also the massive the effects of the 9/11 attacks here in the UK. We experienced a backlash from the public, in the way public perceived, the wide public population, the non-Muslims reacted to that tragic event. We felt the fallout here as well, but not only that, we ourselves experienced a major trauma through the attacks since July 2005, and so I guess 9/11 marked the beginning of this this war on terror era that we have, and how it kind of reformulated the relationship between Western governments and their Muslim communities. I mean, I know it's been arguably more intense in the US, but here in the UK, it really did result in a lot of social change and political change. And there was also, legal change in terms of legislation that was enacted, certainly after the 2005 attacks. So, that kind of, in addition to the emergence of ICT technologies and the availability, the pervasiveness, really, I guess, of Facebook, Twitter, and so on, YouTube, and all of that, and so yeah, I mean, that's what it, in 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 essence, it reconfigured the relationships between religious authorities and Muslim communities. In the sense, it bypassed traditional forms of religious scholarship, religious leadership. I mean, I've argued before that there was a disconnect anyway between the local the mosques that we had and the Muslim communities. In that, you know, young people felt alienated from the mosques. They weren't, you know, turned off by their experiences. And hence, this is one of the reasons why the activist groups were able to attract them. But also, if you like, existing Islamic organizations now could be bypassed by the self-styled religious entrepreneurs that appeared on YouTube, you know, the people who developed a following on Twitter and so on. I mean, this is where we are today. And so even well-known, highly respected individuals like Hamza Yusuf, Abdul Hakim, and so on, have now been displaced by a newer generation of younger, self-styled, so-called religious leaders, religious scholars, or speakers, and that's it's caused, you know, a number of interesting tensions, and there have been consequences. So yes, you have the well-established people, players, and scholars who are reaching out to their audiences through social media, but they themselves now have to compete with younger people who do not necessarily have the religious credentials, and I guess that just a kind of effect of the where we are now in terms of the availability of digital technologies, and the fact that pretty much anybody can, you know, appear in front of a camera and upload content, and if they say something of interest or perhaps create controversy, that then that, you know, is likely to help them develop a profile which they then will cultivate, and it's in terms of academically, it's very interesting to observe and explore these developments, but it has had repercussions within Muslim communities, very much in that expertise has been sometimes underappreciated by people who are qualified to be speaking about and counseling people on certain issues. This is an internal complaint within Muslim communities. People will say, oh, look, you know, rather than go to a qualified person, they will look up their favorite speaker on YouTube. And so, you know, that's where we are today. And I don't spend too much time talking about that in the book, because these are themes which I've explored with a colleague of mine in a forthcoming book, which I might mention later on.
Yeah. And so I'd like to hear a little bit about your future projects, but if I could ask one last question on this notion of expertise and pedagogy and methodology. Have you had a chance to use your book in teaching contexts? And if so, how would you, or in either case, how would you suggest educators employ your book in classroom contexts?
Well, I myself haven't had the opportunity to use my own book as teaching material, because at the moment I actually have a research role. I'm not teaching at the moment, but I do know colleagues have started to incorporate the text as part of their studies on Islam in Britain, religious studies, and I guess it is being used. From the feedback that I've got from around the world, people are using the book as a text on understanding religious identity and religion amongst Muslims in Britain. So Islam in Europe, I guess. So those types of courses, I guess it's becoming. I'm very grateful to see it is being used, and I know it's being taught at university level. I mean, the book itself actually it's had. I try to engage different audiences, reading audiences with the book. Academics, but also people in the media. I've had quite a lot of coverage in the mainstream media and journalists. And I've done a few programs. Recently, I did a program for the BBC World on jihad and the beginnings of the jihad movement here in the UK, and so on. So that's been great. And politicians as well. Policymakers have taken an interest. Some senior politicians here in the UK have told me that they read the book and they found it quite useful in kind of understanding and getting a sense of the mapping of the of British Islam, I guess. And I guess the fourth audience is Muslim communities themselves. People have said, you know, they've read the book and they've agreed or disagreed, and but largely it's been positive. And people have said, you know, it's really good that somebody has actually told the story, if you like. So I'm grateful for that.
Well, cool. That's really exciting to hear that you're getting positive feedback from different kinds of audiences. And certainly as I was reading the book, that was one of the things that struck out to me was how many different kinds of interested readers, you know, might want to pick up this book. And so, Sadiq, thank you so much for your time and letting us interview you. And so if we could ask you a final question, what kinds of current or future projects are you working on, whether they're related to the book or not?
Sure. Yeah, so as I just hinted, a few people have said to me, well, you know, Sadiq, it's great you've done this, but you haven't really said that much about where we are today. And are you going to be writing anything about that? And yes, I said yes. I've been fortunate to, over the last couple of years, co-author a new book with the person I mentioned, actually, who's one of my whose book I was influenced by, Philip Lewis, you know, the author of Islamic Britain. He actually approached me to write a book with him on the contemporary state of Islam in Britain. And so the book is, I'm pleased to be sharing with you the news that it will be out in June with Edinburgh University Press. It's called British Muslims, New Directions in Islamic Thought, Creativity and Activism. So it's kind of like a follow-on to the Sufi Salafis Islamists, and it's like an update for Philip's book, which was Young British and Muslim, which was published about 10 years ago. So we both worked together on this, and we've basically brought the story right up to date in terms of what we feel are the pressing issues that are being discussed by Muslims in Britain today. And really, our primary audience actually is people outside of the Muslim community. So again, we're looking at, you know, academics, teachers, people who work with Muslim communities, social workers, youth workers, the police, and so on, to really provide an accurate and an authoritative analysis of the state of Islam in Britain today. And the reason I say that is because, unfortunately, over the last 10 years, we've had many journalistic attempts which many have been polemic, really, around the Muslim population in the UK. Unfortunately, we've had a number of very kind of well-read kind of bestsellers, I guess, written by people from the Muslim communities as well, people who have been involved. Some of them have been involved in the groups that I've discussed, but they've given a very personal, provocative, and arguably unrepresentative interpretation of what actually happens in Muslim communities. So that's why we felt, you know, it was important to provide an academic kind of counterpoint, if you like. I think that's really important. I know in America you have the same problem as well. These people who are crawling out of the woodwork, so to speak, who are former Muslims or ex-radical Muslims and so on. So you know what I mean? We have that problem here in the UK. And so I think it's really important that academics continue to produce, authoritative, rigorous pieces of scholarship that can provide a balanced picture to what is going on. So that's one of the books I've got coming out. I also have a co-edited volume with my colleague, Professor Tahir Abbas, which is an international comparative of youth activism across the world. So that's coming out with Syracuse University Press towards the end of the year. And finally, I've just finished working on researching for a project here at the Oxford Center for Islamic Studies, where I work with my colleague, Professor Mark Halstead, which looks at the future of Muslims in Europe. And we're doing we've done a four study comparison between Marseille, Brussels, Rotterdam, and the city of Bradford. So, yeah, quite busy. I've been quite busy recently.
Well, that's exciting to hear about these projects. And thank you again so much for sharing your time with us and talking about your book. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you as well.
That was my interview with Dr. Sadiq Hamid, the author of Sufis, Salafis, and Islamists, The Contested Grounds of British Islamic Activism, published by Ivy Torres in 2016. Thanks for listening.